Fox Chase Cancer Center, part of Temple Health, supports WHYY and Lung Cancer Awareness Month. As a major research center, Fox Chase offers both lung cancer screening and advanced treatments for lung cancer, including immunotherapy, chemoradiation, and minimally invasive and robotic lung surgery. In addition, Fox Chase is constantly working to develop new ways to fight lung cancer. Their clinical trials give patients access to new options, sometimes years before they become widely available. Learn more at foxchase.org.
Shaka Chip Fatah Jr.'s three-week-long court battle with federal prosecutors ended today. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A jury convicted Fatah of 22 of 23 federal bank and tax fraud charges. Despite facing about 4 years in federal prison, Fatah maintains confidence that he'll find a way out, as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports.
Shortly after the jury foreman read guilty for 22 counts, Fatah confidently strolled out of the courtroom on the 16th floor of Philadelphia's federal courthouse.
I look forward to a vigorous appeal after sentencing.
Does he regret representing himself and rejecting the free public defender? Not even a little.
I didn't want the representation that I was faced with, primarily because of workload issues and stuff like that, having nothing to do with the particular quality of the lawyers that I was assigned.
Is there anything you wish you did differently over the course of the week?
Absolutely not.
Key to the prosecutor's case was the help of Matthew Amato, Fatah's former roommate and business partner. Amato pleaded guilty to lavishly spending a bank loan intended for working capital for a small business. Amato later wore a wire for the FBI and caught Fatah discussing some of his schemes. Prosecutors played up Fatah's swanky lifestyle to jurors, mentioning his Hermes ties, Italian suits, and $15,000 debt at the Capitol Grill.
So I think that this was kind of like almost like the Wild Wild West,
right,
in many respects, in which everything was allowed that would be to the detriment the defendant, in this case, my son.
That's 11-term Congressman Shaka Fatah, who faces trial on a separate federal corruption case in May. He suggested that the government was out to get his family.
The same identical group of people who've been pursuing me just by accident, right, having nothing to do with me, right, are in this.
The congressman says he's not going to let the government besmirch the Fatah name. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Up until today, Pennsylvania union members have been exempt from charges of stalking, harassment, and threatening to use a weapon of mass destruction in a labor dispute. Governor Tom Wolf signed a bill today ending that protection. Was it a relic of the union-busting early days of organized labor, or a valuable tool to shield today's union members from bogus charges? WHYY Shai Ben Yaakov examines that question.
Serena Rose remembers the day well. It was about 3 years ago, and her company, Post Brothers Construction, was in the middle of building the Gold Tech's apartment building in Philadelphia using some non-union labor.
I walked into a restaurant, and a business agent from the Ironworkers Union started an altercation with me and assaulted me at the counter. He also motioned his hand at me with like a gun shape. Bang, bang, that kind of thing.
Shaken, Rose, the vice president of development for Post Brothers, took her story to the police. But when it went to court, the judge said he was powerless to do anything.
Because this is legal in the state of Pennsylvania.
Up until now, the Labor Anti-Injunction Act shielded union members from prosecution on harassment or stalking charges if they were engaged in a broadly defined labor dispute. Construction lawyer Wally Zimelong says it was a good law back when it was passed. In 1937.
The purpose was to prohibit the criminal codes from being used to thwart labor organizing efforts and to bust strikes.
In the 30s, the nascent labor movement was frequently strong-armed by powerful industrialists, and members were often brought in on trumped-up charges of harassment. In 1937, 10 unarmed union demonstrators in Chicago were shot and killed by police in what would come to be known as the Memorial Day Massacre. But Zimelong says those days are long gone, and the Anti-Injunction Act is now used very differently.
They've evolved into a sword that organized labor wielded in order to sanction conduct that otherwise would have been considered criminal conduct.
What societal cure is this going to provide us?
Pat Gillespie is business manager of the Philadelphia Building and Construction Trades Council. Gillespie says the law signed by Governor Wolf rolls back protections for workers that are still necessary.
This is owners and management who are very abusive towards their employees, and those employees have a right to stand out in the public square and tell that person that. By Wolf signing this, he will stifle that.
Governor Wolf said in a statement, quote, "I believe it's important to allow men and women to come together and have their voices heard. I also believe that any form of harassment by employees or employers is unacceptable." I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov, WHYY News.
Listeners to Marketplace following NewsWorks tonight, weeknight at 6:30, come to count on Kai Rizdahl for a roadmap to navigate the twists and turns of the economy. Twisting, turning, and churning is how some describe their digestive system when asked to consider how the economy feels on a personal level. And joining me with a diagnosis is Marketplace host and senior editor Kai Rizdahl. Kai, thanks for being here.
Dave, so glad to do it. Good to talk to you.
Now, I listened to your show. Unemployment's down. GDP is up. The recession ended years ago. I guess it's too easy to prescribe less coffee or Red Bull to ease the anxiety.
That's right. That is too easy. As you said, the recession ended 5.5 years ago. We're adding jobs every month. GDP, the gross domestic product, is growing. And yet what we have found in all of our reporting since 2008, really, since Lehman Brothers went under, is that people are not feeling the recovery. People in their daily lives, in their own economies, are not feeling the recovery. So why do this survey? Because we wanted to quantify what we've been seeing and hearing in our reporting. We wanted to know what it is that people are worried about. And it turns out there are many, many things people are worried about in this economy.
And so you, partnering with Edison Research, have come up with something called the Economic Anxiety Index. And wait for it. Let's do the numbers.
Oh, man. Did you plan that one? So here's the thing about the anxiety index. Before I tell you exactly what it is and what the numbers are, you have to know that we're going to do this survey 3 more times before Election Day. So we're going to be able to track this over a year. What we did was we took some of the more quantitative questions in our polling. We sort of normalized them. We put them on a scale of 0 to 100. And we came up with an overall anxiety index in this country of 31 out of 100, which on the face of it doesn't sound that high. But when you break it down, when you look at the various groups within it, you learn some interesting things, some surprising, some not so much. For example, Latinos in this country score 44 out of 100 on the anxiety scale. That is to say 13 points above the mean. Whites, not surprisingly, 28 points, that is to say, below the mean. So there are really big splits and bifurcations in this economy on race and gender lines, on economic status lines, on what kind of work you do lines, how you get paid, all sorts of stuff.
Though perhaps optimistically, apparently most still believe that hard work pays.
Well, so that was the amazing thing. 80% of the people in this country believe the American dream is alive and well. It's different, but it's alive and well. And they believe that if you work hard, you can make it. You have an opportunity within this system to excel and to achieve and to get to that thing that we call the American dream.
Though another paradox related, it seems that younger respondents most clearly believe this, even though the road for them might be the most daunting.
Yeah, they do. They are the ones who most believe it, but they are also the ones who are most anxious because they are the ones, these 25 to 30-something year olds, they are the ones who came out of high school into the teeth of the Great Recession and went through all through college with unemployment at 10% and graduated a couple of years ago with it being really, really hard, the hardest in generations to find a job in this economy. But they're young. They've got a lot of runway in front of them, and so they have opportunity. And that, I think, is what they're talking about.
Tell us about some more surprises in the polls.
My favorite one actually is hourly versus salaried workers. If you are an hourly worker in this economy, 43% of them say they feel stuck in their jobs. They feel there is nowhere to go.
That's
now,
huge.
Why is that? It's enormous. Think about basically 50% of the people in hourly jobs feeling that they have nowhere to go. They're not getting raises. Their starting salaries have probably been low. But on the other hand, salaried employees, people who are paid, you know, regular paychecks, they're way down. They're 21% on feeling anxious and stuck about things. The splits inside this economy are actually fascinating.
Are salaried workers more likely to have full-time positions, though, relative to hourly, where it could be up to 40 hours?
That's exactly right. So the big thing in unemployment the last couple of years has been this number called U6, which is, I think the technical term is partially detached workers, right? It's people who want more hours but can't get them. And that is certainly part of the problem. It absolutely is.
Kai, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
pleasure, Dave. Talk to you soon.
Marketplace host and senior editor Kai Rizdahl. You can learn more about the Economic Anxiety Index at marketplace.org, and you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. What if you found out you weren't really who you thought you were? A Westchester University project is using DNA testing to unearth surprises and start conversations about identity and race. WHYY's Sarah Hoover reports.
Before the students at Westchester University can trace their roots, they have to learn how the DNA testing kits work.
There is a little tube there with a little funnel on top.
They're part of the project One University, One Ancestry that looks at the DNA of Westchester students, faculty, and alumni. Anita Foman, communication studies professor, founded it.
And I thought, now wouldn't it be interesting to test somebody and see if their ancestry DNA said the same thing that they did in their narrative about their racial background?
The project kicked off this summer, but Foman has been interested in the subject for years. She'll have tested more than 1,000 people by the end of the semester.
I found in particular that the narratives of somebody's racial background tended to be very simple, but their actual ancestry was quite complicated.
Communication studies professor Bessie Lawton is working with Foman on the project. She says people tend to think of themselves as only one race, but test results usually tell a different story.
Everybody in their DNA profile has more than one race or ethnicity.
She says that's partly because people either overestimate or underestimate race in their background.
People who think they are white overestimate that they are white. And there's a lot of underestimation, especially for categories such as Asian and Latino.
She says the disparity is also because family histories are usually only a few hundred years, while genetic information can span thousands of years. Lawton says this goes beyond promoting diversity and reducing prejudice by talking to people who are different.
If you add the story of genotypes and you find out that that difference is within yourself, that you're not just white or you're not just black, it makes you start to think about, well, maybe I am not that different from other people.
Before testing, participants fill out a survey of how they identify, then complete a second survey after they have the results. Senior Daniel Schwartzman was confident he's 100% Haitian.
If it turns out I'm not Haitian or turns out that I'm from Sweden or something, I don't know.
That's the 22-year-old this summer before he got his test results. Schwartzman's DNA says he's 92% African and 8% European.
It's crazy to be 8%. I mean, that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you don't think you're 80%, I'd probably assume I'm 100% African. So it's crazy, but it does make sense.
The project seeks to foster more positive discussions about race. High school teacher Michael Santangelo hopes to do that too.
Hi guys, good to see everybody today. It's Friday.
He's teaching an American government class to seniors at Norristown Area High School.
We called some countries homogeneous, but what does that mean? Does that mean racially they were similar?
The social studies teacher got tested as a way to connect to his diverse students. The school is 46% black, 30% white, and 23% Latino.
If I could show them that I had diversity and they didn't see me as just the white guy teacher, I thought that would be a good way to kind of open the door to the discussion on race.
Since he's Italian, he thought he might have African ancestry.
But what came back was close to 10% Middle Eastern.
The class is discussing what the characteristics of a country are, including population.
Okay, let's start with race. How do we define it? How do you define it? How do you think other people define it?
But even when I had them define race, they looked very reluctant to want to define it, because I think it has been sort of a taboo subject.
He hopes the DNA discussion project will change that.
It's not something you could test on some sort of state test, but I think it's more important for us to, you know, realize that we're preparing citizens to go out in the world. And if we can have them open up and have some very good discussions about race, nationality, ethnicity, I think that would be a good thing.
Santangelo is trying to get grant funding to get his students tested. Each kit costs $120. Researchers at Westchester will share their findings in the spring. They hope to reveal a few surprises, like when Westchester University President Greg Weisenstein got tested. He thought he was German and Austrian. His DNA results showed European, African, Asian, and Middle Eastern ancestry. For WHYY News, I'm Sarah Hoover.
Turning to this evening's headlines, a Pennsylvania judge is turning down Jerry Sandusky's request for information about a grand jury that investigated him before charges were filed in 2011. Judge John Cleland issued the order today, hours after concluding a closed-door hearing to question the state's attorney general about what she might have known about contacts between the grand jury's supervisory judge and prosecutors. Cleland says Attorney General Kathleen Kane told him she has no knowledge of any efforts by Judge Barry Feudale or state prosecutors to leak secret grand jury material about Sandusky. The former Penn State assistant football coach is currently appealing a 45-count conviction for child sexual abuse. A Philadelphia woman was sentenced today in federal court to life plus 80 years in prison. Linda Weston pleaded guilty in September to all charges in a racketeering and hate crimes case. It involved holding mentally disabled adults captive in locked closets, basements, and attics in Philadelphia's Tacony section, as well as in other states. In addition to the prison term, Weston was ordered to make restitution of over $250,000 to the Social Security Administration. Cloudy, 64 degrees at 6:22. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Remaining overcast overnight, low 60 degrees. Cloudy tomorrow, Friday's high approaching 80. Saturday, partly sunny, high only 63 degrees. There's a chance of a stray shower in the morning. Sunny days, Sunday and Monday, high both days in the mid-50s. Still ahead, a new project at Roxborough's Saul Agricultural High School offers the sweet smell of success.
In the morning, you get a little stinky, but that's zoo stuff that hasn't been mixed in yet.
The student farmers add composting to their stable of skills. We'll breathe easy when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
If your child is struggling in school, why wait to make a change? Supporting WHYY Delaware Valley Friends, a Quaker College preparatory school in Paoli for students who learn differently. Delaware Valley Friends is committed to providing small classes, individual attention, state-of-the-art technology, and an accredited curriculum and faculty. An information session is Sunday, November 8th from 1 to 3. More information about Delaware Valley Friends at dvfs.org. Now considering applications for grades 6 through 11.
What makes people feel good about their economy? Opportunity is one thing.
We have many people that we brought in that have started in operations, and through those years of operations, those people have actually got to the point where we have many of them in senior positions.
I'm Kai Rizdal, more from Alabama and our series My Economy next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6:30 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. A Los Angeles-based modern dance troupe has been asked by the U.S. State Department to serve as cultural ambassadors to Israel and Jordan. The troupe, called Body Traffic, is just back from 5 weeks in the Middle East. Philadelphia is its first stop on the way back home to Los Angeles. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports.
For its five-day run at the Prince Theater in Philadelphia, Body Traffic will dance to this. It's American jazz. The company had just taken this music to the Middle East for performances and workshops. For example, in Jerusalem, they worked with a collective of women choreographers who perform exclusively for women. Body Traffic artistic director Tina Finkelman-Burkett says those women removed their traditional headscarves to dance in a workshop inside a bomb shelter.
And they perform only for women. They have sold out houses sometimes separately. They're now coming together to make this collective, but each of them as choreographers were telling me that they've had shows for 500 women in the audience, packed.
Body Traffic was in Israel for 3 weeks, in Jordan for two, at the invitation of the U.S. State Department. The point, she says, was to represent the joy of American dance. Burkett also felt a need to represent her American Jewish heritage while in Israel.
Being a Jew in Israel, there's an added layer of responsibility that I feel as an American Jew. When I went to Jordan, the embassy actually really encouraged us to not talk about religion and in particular not to reveal that I am Jewish.
Burkett says her role as cultural ambassador was meant to start dialogues in Jordan about dance, and mentioning her religion would have immediately shut down that dialogue. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia Zoo, local breweries, and coffee roasters all have one thing in common. They all turn their waste into compost at a farm along Henry Avenue in the Roxborough section of the Philadelphia city. WHYY's Nima Roshania explains.
It's a Wednesday morning at the W.B. Saul High School Farm in Roxboro. The latest additions to the farm's compost are coming together. Breweries drop off spent grain, coffee roasters bring by used grounds and bean chaff. That's the husk that comes off the beans during roasting. And the Philadelphia Zoo dumps 3,000 pounds of its manure, hay, and leftovers.
In the morning, you get a little stinky, but that's zoo stuff that hasn't been mixed in yet.
That's volunteer Scott Blunk. He says well-maintained compost will not stink up the neighborhood, and the site was chosen with wind direction in mind. He's even given his phone number to neighbors just in case. On this day, he's busy adding 500 pounds of food scraps from local co-op Weaver's Way to the mix.
Very rarely will you see anything that you can imagine somebody using. It's always a treat when I find an apple that's got a big bruise in it, you know, because I have a pocket knife and I cut the bruise out.
Three times a week, every week, Blunk picks up the scraps and hauls it all to the farm. He even gets the occasional emergency phone call, like when a fridge stops working and all the produce inside is going bad. A few years ago, W.B. Saul, Philadelphia's only agriculture high school, was paying to have its waste hauled away and buying compost made on mushroom farms in Kennett Square. Blunk teamed up with the school and local partners to take that money and build facilities so they could make their own compost. Today, the compost mounds pile high and stretch down about 240 feet. The lot that's being added today will sit for about 7 months before it's ready to be processed.
So here you can identify there's leaves and straw, and I see a lettuce leaf, and I see part of a pumpkin hull, and then I see some coffee grounds and some coffee filters and odds and ends. So then as you drive down the pile, as it gets older and older and older, you'll notice that it gets darker and darker and darker, and it's harder and harder and harder to identify anything.
When the compost is ready, whatever can't be reused on the school's farm will be sold for residential use. The proceeds go back to the students Blunk works with at W.B. Saul. Blunk spends a lot of his time teaching people exactly what is compostable and weeding out the rest.
I always say it's the bane of my existence, rubber bands and twisty ties.
A good compost balances all the right components, explains Tim Bennett, owner of Bennett Compost. His company picks up residential waste from houses throughout the city.
In some ways, it's like making a cake. Like, you want to have control over the ingredients. You don't, like, that's how you get a good product in the end.
For WHYY, I'm Nima Roshanya.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. It's a fact of elementary school life. Sooner or later, most kids get a case of head lice. And on tomorrow's show, we'll hear from school nurses who are trying to convince parents not to panic. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
Wood Services proudly supports WHYY. Since 1913, Wood Services has helped change the lives of children and adults with special needs, like Maddie. Arriving at the age of 15, Maddie had access to the meaningful care and life-altering supports that Woods provides to individuals on the autism spectrum who deal with frequent angry outbursts. 2 years later, Maddie is bringing joy to her family and those around her. Woods helps people with special needs achieve success. Learn more at woods.org. Wood Services. Exceptional people. Fulfilling lives.